Welcome to SCOTUS Cast, Non-Resident Access to Public Records Edition. Thank you for tuning in. On April 29, 2013, the Supreme Court announced its decision in McBurney v. Young. The question in the case was whether Virginia's Freedom of Information Act, or FOIA, violates the Privileges and Immunities Clause of Article 4 and the Dormant Commerce Clause of the United States Constitution by declining to grant citizens of other states the right to access the public records that Virginia affords its own citizens. In a unanimous opinion delivered by Justice Alito, the court held that Virginia's FOIA does not violate the Privileges and Immunities Clause or the Dormant Commerce Clause. Justice Thomas filed a concurring opinion. To discuss the case, we have Christopher Green, who is a professor at the University of Mississippi School of Law and currently visiting at the University of San Diego School of Law. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker. And now, Professor Green.
Hi, this is Christopher Green, Associate Professor of Law at the University of Mississippi, visiting at the University of San Diego. The Supreme Court today released McBurney v. Young, unanimously rejecting Dormant Commerce Clause and Privileges and Immunities Clause challenges to the residence-only provision of Virginia's state Freedom of Information law. The case perhaps looked more interesting at the oral argument than it does now. Justice Alito, who wrote the opinion, actually didn't ask any questions at the argument in February. As I said last month in my post-argument podcast, this was a case with a clear circuit split, so it was not a big surprise that the court affirmed, and on grounds pretty similar to the Fourth Circuit's opinion, which the court obviously liked better than the Third Circuit's Lee opinion from 2006. There were two more theoretically interesting aspects to the opinion. The court first adopted a protectionist purpose reading of the Privileges and Immunities Clause of Article 4, at least in the context of common calling privileges. Hurlburt, a plaintiff with a records-gathering business, said that calling would be hindered by residence-only limit, but the mere disparate impact on a common calling, as exercised by non-residents, was not enough. Justice Alito wrote, "The court has struck down laws as violating the privilege of pursuing a common calling only when those laws were enacted for the protectionist purpose of burdening out-of-state citizens." Here, the court relied not on any such explicit statement in earlier cases, but an inference from the fact patterns of earlier common calling, privileges, and immunities cases, all of which had involved protectionist purposes. So is this a Washington v. Davis case for the Privileges and Immunities Clause generally? Well, the court didn't say so. That's certainly the vibe. Second, the court reaffirmed the historically rooted test for fundamental privileges under Article 4, first set out in Corfield v. Coryell in 1825. Only if a right has at all times been enjoyed by the citizens of the several states which compose this union from the time of their becoming free, independent, and sovereign, in the language of Corfield, does it count. So newly emergent privileges, like the privilege of participating in a national information market, don't count. The court cited several common law cases limiting the right of access to public records to those with a personal interest, unlike the state and federal FOIA laws which have emerged since the 1960s. The court also rejected two more specific Privileges and Immunities Clause arguments related to the privilege to get records related to property and to access judicial records. Both of these privileges were adequately covered by other laws, the court held. So Virginia's residence-only restriction in its FOIA law did not have any significant impact. In particular, the court noted that McBurney, the plaintiff who wanted records related to the state's enforcement of his child support rights, was able to get judicial records related to his case, although not all the administrative records he wanted. Finally, the court rejected the argument that the Dormant Commerce Clause put any restriction on articles of commerce that the state could produce, like the information and documents. The court did not even mention Reno v. Condon, the chief case on which the petitioner had relied, holding that information documents could be an article of commerce. This failure to create a market or release an article into commerce was not the sort of regulation covered by the Dormant Commerce Clause, the court said today. Markets and articles of commerce must be pre-existing for the Dormant Commerce Clause to kick in. This is the same principle as applied to the positive commerce clause that the Supreme Court approved, but only 5-4, in NFIB v. Sebelius from last spring. The positive commerce clause only covers pre-existing commerce. Justice Ginsburg and three other justices dissented vigorously. Today, though, the court avoided drawing any such analogy, which probably makes sense given the unanimity of the court today and its emphatic non-unanimity in NFIB last year. Justice Thomas added a short concurrence reiterating his long-held view that the Dormant Commerce Clause is bunk because, being dormant, it isn't actually in the constitutional text. The court gave a nod to that view, but said that since they've been enforcing Dormant Commerce Clause limits since 1852 and taking them seriously, at least since 1824, they'd keep on doing it, just not doing it in this case. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUS Cast. For more episodes of SCOTUS Cast, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at www.federalistsociety.org/multimedia.